Good morning. It's nice to see you all here this morning. Well, this morning we reach the finale of our story, don't we? We finally find out how it ends. If you're joining us for the first time this week, for the past several weeks, we've been walking through the story of Ruth. Ruth is written as a drama in four acts, and each act corresponds with the chapter. So this week is chapter four, Restoration, in which all the pieces which we've been following in the story finally start to come together. So if you want to go ahead and turn there, Ruth chapter 4. We'll go through the whole chapter. And while you're doing that, let me do a quick review just to ensure that everybody's on the same page and everybody's up to speed. We saw back in chapter 1 that Naomi, her husband, and her two sons had moved from Bethlehem during a famine to the land of Moab to escape the famine conditions. While they were there, sadly, Naomi's husband died, and then later her two sons died. So faced with the only choice left available to her, she packs up and decides to move back home to Bethlehem, but she does not return alone. She brings with her ever-faithful daughter-in-law, Ruth. They were two poor widows with very few means of survival, and we saw in chapter 2 a man named Boaz came to the rescue. You remember, Boaz was a relative of Naomi's deceased husband, Elimelech, and he came to the rescue and provided for them generously, and provided food and protection for them. Through his generosity, they were able to survive. Now, if you remember, in chapter 3, we saw that Boaz was a kinsman redeemer. The Hebrew is goel. That means that it was his job to be the guardian of the clan, the guardian of the unity of the family and their property. So if a kinsman went into debt and had to sell a piece of property in order to pay it off, it was the goel's responsibility, it was Boaz's responsibility to go out and buy that property and bring it back into the family holdings. And if a relative had to sell himself into slavery to pay off a debt, it was Boaz's responsibility to go out and buy him back and bring him back within the circle of the family. Now, when we left off last week, if you remember, Ruth, under Naomi's guidance, had approached Boaz in a very unusual manner, and she had presented him with a special request. Now, the request wasn't perhaps that unusual at the time, but she asked him to marry her, redeem her, by marrying her. Now, Ruth was part of the clan, remember, through the marriage to Naomi's son, and she asked to be protected, to be kept in the clan, be protected and provided for through the covenant of marriage. And Boaz, of course, knowing what a wonderful woman she was, jumped at the opportunity. But there was a problem, if you remember, when we left off. There was another kinsman redeemer who technically, according to however the family hierarchy worked, he was closer than Boaz to Elimelech and Naomi, and technically it was his responsibility. By custom, it would have been his responsibility to provide and care for Ruth and Naomi, even to the point of marrying Ruth. And I argued last week that he had not done it, that he had not stepped up to his responsibility, and he was leaving Ruth and Naomi in a type of limbo. But of course, Boaz, being the gentleman that he was, knew he had to follow the custom. And so he had to check with the man first to see if he wanted to redeem Ruth. So when we left off, Ruth and Naomi were waiting in the home that they shared, waiting for Boaz, who had gone to town, to approach this man and present the issue with him. Now, before we get into the text, I have to tell you that the first dozen verses or so, we're going to be looking at some rather arcane and ancient Hebrew legalities, which is not as much fun as I'm sure you would have imagined. But what we're going to do is we're going to go through it slow. We're going to take a few verses at a time and work our way through it because it's important that we see how this is all coming together to paint the picture. But of course, there's always something we can learn from the text. And the first thing I want to bring out, first point that we can learn from the text is that faithlessness is shameful. Faithlessness is shameful. Now follow along with me and you'll see what I mean. Beginning in verse 1, it reads, "Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz said, 'Come over here, my friend, and sit down.' So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, 'Sit here.' And they did so. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, 'Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech.'" That's probably not literally their brother, and he's probably just using it as a way of referring to him as a close relative. Boaz continues, "I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line. I will redeem it, he said. Let me stop right there. So the town gate that we see in verses 1 and 2, the town gate was the center of city life in ancient Near East. Everybody had to pass through the town gate at some point or another during the day. They had to go out through the town gate to work the fields, or if they wanted just to travel from one location to another, one city to another, they had to go through the town gate. So Boaz knows that all he's got to do is go hang out at the town gate, and eventually this man he's looking for will show up there. It was also the place where the town elders congregated. It was sort of the town courthouse where people could come and present their issues, their civil or legal or family matters, to the town elders and have them settled or taken care of. And so clearly Boaz, by having them sit in one spot and the kinsman redeemer sit in another spot, he's wanting to resolve this in a very formal and legal manner with lots of witnesses. And then in verses 3 and 4, there's some question about what's going on here, about the nature of this transaction, because it was very unusual for a widow to be selling her husband's property. According to the law, according to Numbers 28, a man's property, if he were to die, went to his children, and if he didn't have any children, it would go to his blood relatives. It did not go to his widow. The widow was to be cared for in a different manner. So we've got a couple of options for this circumstance. Either Naomi really is selling it, that somehow there's something unusual going on here, and Naomi really has possession of it, and she is selling it, which would seem to be the easiest reading of the text. Or there's another possibility that requires some speculation on our part, that perhaps her husband had sold it many years ago, prior to these events, and that she, as the widow, somehow managed to retain the right to buy it back or the right to use it, and that's what she's getting rid of. That's what she's handing over, not the property itself, but particular rights. It doesn't really matter. Now, the first readers, they would have understood exactly what was going on here, but we are separated by time and distance, so we're missing some pieces. But what's clearly evident is that this is her last stand. She's getting rid of the last piece of property, the last thing she and her husband own, the last bit of her husband's name she is about to hand over. So Boaz lays it out to the kinsman that it's his responsibility to buy it back. Keep it in the family circle. And if he's not going to do it, then he needs to tell Boaz so Boaz can do it, because he's next in line and he wants to do it. So much to our consternation, the other kinsman says, yeah, I'll do it. So what he does is he pulls out his guide to financial responsibility and starts to thumb through it. And he realizes, okay, I could spend some money now and I get the land and I get to work it and I get all the profits from the crops. But he realizes that there would be an expense, that he would have to take care of Naomi, probably, for the rest of her life. But since she has no heirs, no survivors, the land is free and clear his. He gets to keep it. It stays in his family. It expands his estate. It goes to his kids when he passes away. It seems like a good investment. And clearly, that's not what we want to hear. We've been following Ruth and Boaz for this long, and now we're starting to wonder, oh, what's going to happen now? And then in verse 5, Boaz lowers the boom. Follow along. Boaz said, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, by the way, and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. At this, the kinsman redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. So Boaz, in addition to the land, publicly calls on this man to redeem Ruth by marrying her. Now, I know what you're thinking. It sounds like Ruth is being bought and sold like a piece of property. And that's not quite the case here. Understand that in this culture, it's of the utmost importance to keep the family name alive. Keep the family name alive. Don't let it die. Don't let it be annihilated from the records of Israel. So without any surviving sons, the name of Elimelech, Naomi's husband, will vanish. And without any surviving sons, then the ancestral property, the property that's been in the family for generations, will go to the hands of a stranger. So Boaz is asking that the kinsmen marry Ruth, and their children, at least their first son probably, would then be counted not as this kinsman redeemer's son, but it would be counted as Elimelech's son, sort of a reverse form of adoption. That way, Elimelech's name would be kept alive. And then, when the kinsman redeemer dies, that property would then go to the children that he had with Ruth, or at least the oldest or firstborn son. That way it keeps the property in the family and it keeps the name of Elimelech alive. It's all about the family circle. It's all about family unity, clan unity. And I realize that's a very different perspective than what we have here in the West. So Boaz is calling on the man not just to redeem in part. Don't just do half the job. He says, don't just redeem the land, redeem the woman. Keep the family name alive by marrying Elimelech's widow. So the man pulls his guide to financial responsibility back out. And he starts to thumb through it. And he realizes, okay, so if I buy the land, I spend some money now. And yes, I get to work the land and I get to keep the crops. I get the profit from the crops. But then I got to take care of Naomi. And I got to take care of Ruth, and he may already have another wife. So he has to take care of Ruth. He has to take care of any children they may have. And then in the end, he doesn't get to keep the land anyway. It goes out. So to him, it seems like a bad investment. So he makes a reasonable and rational decision and turns the offer down. Picking up in verse 7 then, see what Boaz does next, or what happens next. Now in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself. And he removed his sandal. So the author takes a break and he explains this different legal custom that apparently had even died out by the time the author is writing the story. And he's explaining to the readers that usually what happened, or stepping on a piece of property in biblical times, was a sign of ownership. You stepped on it, you claimed it in your name. So what the kinsman redeemer does is he takes off his shoe and he says, basically, with this shoe, I would have stepped on the property, I would have claimed it for my own, and I'm giving up my right to do that, and I'm handing it to you so you can do it. Look how Boaz responds then in verse 9. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. Those were her two sons. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses, he proclaims. Then the elders and all those at the gate said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Excuse me. So the family, the elders, apparently a group of people, have congregated to watch this happen. And after Boaz is done, they put their stamp of approval on it. We approve of this, they say, and now it's been entered into the town memory. Remember, they passed knowledge not through writing, but they passed knowledge orally. So they are going to remember this, and they are going to pass it down to their children and to the succeeding generations what has happened. And they wish Boaz well with his future wife and pray that his family will be like Perez's family. This was an ancestor of Boaz. He was a son of Judah and Tamar, and apparently his tribe, his clan, had become very prominent during the time, and so they're just wishing the very best for Boaz and Ruth. May your family be like their family. So I know you. I appreciate you hanging on with me as we kind of walk through this arcane stuff. So now let's try to pull it all together and talk about what it means for us. One of the main goals I hope you're seeing in this scene is that it's important. It is of the utmost importance to that culture to keep the family name alive. It's unimaginable to let the family name die. You don't want that to happen. So, pop quiz. What's the name of the other kinsman redeemer? We don't know. Ironically, we don't know. The narrator never tells us. In fact, go back to verse 1, if you have. Verse 1, chapter 4. When Boaz says, come over here, my friend, and sit down, that's not what he says in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, he says, come over here, Poloni Almoni, which is Hebrew for roughly so-and-so. Come over here, so-and-so. So if we read the text literally, like it's written, Boaz, he goes, come over here, dude, and sit here. I need to talk to you about something. Now, is that what we're really supposed to believe? that Boaz has forgotten this man's name? Well, of course not. It's his relative. And Bethlehem is a small village. You can be sure that he addressed him by his name. It's just that the narrator refuses to mention this man's name. Think about it another way. Everybody in the story of Ruth gets a name. Ruth, Boaz, Naomi, we even know the other daughter-in-law's name, Orpah, and she's only on stage for a couple of verses. We know the names of Naomi's husband and of her two sons, and they're dead. They're not even in the story. Even in chapter 2, if you remember when Ruth first met Boaz, there is the foreman of Boaz's servants. Now, we don't know his name. He has a speaking part. He has a major role. We don't know his name, but at least he gets the dignity of a title. He is the foreman of Boaz's servants. This man, this other kinsman redeemer, we have no idea who he is. We don't know what he does. We know nothing about him other than the fact that he is related. And in a culture where keeping the name alive is of the utmost importance, why would the narrator do this? It's his subtle way of shaming this man for not redeeming Ruth. The other kinsman acted out of faithlessness. He took a look at his estate. He took a look at the impact of adding Ruth to it, and he made a rational and reasonable decision. But sometimes the rational and reasonable decision is not the faithful decision. This man was a Jew. He knew the law. He knew the stories of God's goodness and his grace to the people. He knew this word, hesed. Do you remember this word? This word popped up in chapter 1 and in chapter 2 and chapter 3. It's a theme of the book. Hesed means loyal love, faithful love, loving kindness. And God demonstrated hesed to the people of Israel and then expected them to demonstrate hesed, loyal love with one another. Watch out for each other. Take care of one another. Live in loyal love with one another. And this man didn't do it. He thought only of his estate. He did not think of Elimelech's legacy. He did not think of the well-being of Ruth or Naomi. Remember, Boaz, in contrast, faced the same conditions that this man did. If he married Ruth, he would have to take care of her, and he was going to have to take care of Naomi. At least the firstborn son of theirs would be counted not as his, but it would be counted as Elimelech. He would have to see, Boaz would have to watch this land go from his holding over to his firstborn son's holding. He faced the exact same conditions that this man did, but he did it anyway. He acted faithfully. Sometimes living in faithfulness to the Word of God, to what He has called you to do, will not look rational or reasonable. And we talked about this last week, didn't we? For somebody who knows the Word of God, like this man, and who knows his calling and what he's supposed to do, and to not be faithful, to act out of faithlessness, is shameful. And for those of us today who have seen God's love and His faithfulness demonstrated to us through Christ, who live in a place where God has given us so much, and to make a decision based solely on our own well-being, without considering the larger body of Christ or the impact that our decisions would have for the kingdom of God, to not consider those factors is shameful. We miss out on an opportunity to be part of something grand, something larger than ourselves. And we see, as we read through this story, that that's exactly what happened to this man. He missed out on a chance to be part of something grand, something bigger than himself, and his name disappeared from history. Fortunately, God was not surprised by this, was he? Boaz was never plan B for God. And of course, as fans of Boaz, we couldn't be happier. So let's continue on with the story. Remember, faithlessness is shameful, but conversely, God will use the faithfulness of ordinary people to accomplish the extraordinary. Picking up in verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Let me stop there for a minute. Who gets credit for enabling Ruth to conceive? The Lord. Once more, the narrator demonstrates that nothing that has happened in this story has not been caused or directed or ordained by God. And the women of the town in verse 14, presumably these are the same women that saw Naomi return home in chapter 1 in bitterness and in brokenness, and now they get to be witnesses of her newfound happiness. They proclaim that her grandson will be her kinsman redeemer. He will be her guardian. He's going to take care of her. And then they proclaim, oddly, that Ruth is better than 7 sons. And what does that mean? Well, again, remember, this is an agricultural society. You get 7 strapping sons to go out there and work the land for you, to take care of the crops and work the, that's, nothing gets better than that. Life is good. You got 7 boys out there to work for you. You get to go to the town gate and hang out. You get to be an elder then. Life is good with 7 sons. But yet, they say, Ruth is better than 7 sons. Because sons are obligated to take care of their families. But Ruth took care of Naomi of her own accord and at great sacrifice. And then picking up in verse 16, we see that Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son, and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. That's a plot twist. Did you see that coming? You did? Well, the first readers would not have seen it coming. This would have been something new to them. This would have been something big to them. And the placing of the boy in the lap is a sign of that this is Naomi's special boy. She has been given special charge of him. And the townswomen say that this is Naomi's son. This is not Ruth and Boaz's son. This is Naomi's son. And it's the townswomen, interestingly, not his parents, that name him. And they name him Obed, who became the grandfather of David, their great king. And then our narrator ends our story with a genealogy. He writes, this then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon. Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz. Boaz the father of Obed. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse the father of David. It's kind of unusual, isn't it? And we wouldn't imagine that he would end a story with a genealogy. But the genealogy provides a clue to the purpose of the book. Remember back, way back in chapter 1, verse 1, when did the narrator tell us that the story took place? During the time of the judges. Have you read Judges lately? Judges is a horrible book. And by that, I mean the acts within it are appalling. And the more you study Judges, the worse it gets. It was a black time in Israel's history. It was violent. It was chaotic. And the final verse of Judges summarizes it aptly. It says, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. So in general, the nation didn't follow the law. They didn't follow God. They had no regard for God and the law. They did what they wanted to do. And they had no king to model righteousness or provide law and order for them. But the author of Ruth tells us that even during that ugly time, God was still in control. That he was behind the scenes bringing about the birth of the man David, who would become their great king. The narrator wanted to show that the reign of David resulted from neither his shrewd politics nor his clever tactics, but from the divine preservation of his worthy family line, and therefore Israel was to accept David's kingship as the gift of divine guidance. David did not become king because he was the best fighter, and David did not become king because he was a conniving politician. He did not become king because he ripped the throne from Saul's descendants. He became king because God wanted him to become king. And God took measures to ordain his family line from the beginning. But of course, we know that the story doesn't end there, don't we? Looking at it from this side of the New Testament, we know that Naomi had another grandson, a great, 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 however many great grandson. By the name of Emmanuel, God with us, Jesus Christ, the Messiah of Israel, the rightful King of earth. And we see that without Ruth and her faithful actions, there would have been no Jesus. God's plan for his kingdom missed no details. It extended all the way down to a hurting, lonely Moabite woman in a land that was not her own, caught up in a chaotic time. And though Ruth and Naomi and Boaz, they didn't see the full impact of their faithful actions, we see it now. Generations later, we see that God uses the faithfulness of ordinary people to do great and extraordinary things. If I could adapt something that I heard Dr. Mark Bailey, president of Dallas Seminary, I heard him say this in a chapel once, and if I could adapt what he said to our story, God in his great wisdom and in his kindness to the rest of us asked Ruth and Naomi to suffer and to suffer and endure faithfully to bring a message that the rest of us so desperately need. And their example of faithfulness still changes and impacts and shapes the body of Christ today, 3,000 years later. In the same way, God has already asked certain members of this body, or he's going to ask certain members of this body to endure sufferings, to endure something, some type of hardship. And he's going to ask us to endure it faithfully, to serve as models of faithfulness to each other, to serve as our example and as our inspiration and as our teachers, so that we can see the faithfulness and the glory of God demonstrated in our midst. And we may not see, at least in this life, the glory that our faithful endurance brings to Christ. We may not see the final impact our endurance, our faithfulness, and even our suffering does. We won't see the final impact it has on the kingdom. Ruth and Naomi certainly didn't. They were just two lonely, broken widows trying to survive. And yet they acted faithfully, and their actions resonate thousands of years later. They see the impact of their actions now, don't they? And that's our certain hope, is that someday we will see the end result of our faithfulness, of our endurance. Our certain hope is that we will see it, if not in our lifetime, then on that day when the rightful King of Earth returns and sets everything right.